Welcome to the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
What's at the end of this case? How did this come about? Are you in the pay of the Microsoft Corporation?
Sure, with the text of the Second Amendment.
Your Honor, I think that could be viewed as political, that would be...
How about the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think the First Amendment...
You're out again. Still out.
I think we're all textual.
Welcome to episode 196 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. We have three cases again today, two from the Illinois Supreme Court and one from the Illinois Appellate Court, First District. We're closing in on 200 episodes just in about a month. First case today is from the Illinois Appellate Court, First District, Moore versus S&C. The second is from the Illinois Supreme Court, Kuhn versus Owners Insurance Company. And the third is from the Illinois Supreme Court as well, Rice versus Marathon. Turning to our first case. An American plaintiff was injured at a job in Toronto, Canada, while working for Reliable on a project to install cameras at a facility owned by S&C Electric Canada, whose parent was S&C Electric, based in Illinois. After S&C Electric Canada was dismissed for lack of personal jurisdiction and discovery was completed, S&C Electric moved for summary judgment, and the trial court granted that motion, applying Canadian law and stating, quote, upon comparing these facts to those of the aforementioned cases wherein Canadian courts found a duty of care, the court does not find sufficient similarity to find such a duty. S&C Electric was not in privity of contract with Reliable. They did not oversee this project or direct it, either beforehand or during. It may be true that were it not for S&C Electric's recommendation, S&C Canada may never have contracted with Reliable, but that is not certain. Even if it were, a mere causation between an act by the defendant and the eventual injury establishes neither a duty of care nor foreseeability. The court finds it unlikely that S&C Electric could have foreseen this injury occurring because, as discussed above, the nature of the injury was not squarely within the type of risk that one would expect given the nature of the project. Even if S&C Electric could have foreseen the injury, there is no degree of control, supervision, or relationship between S&C Electric and Moore to place S&C Electric under a duty of care towards Moore. Therefore, because Moore has not raised a genuine issue of material fact as to whether S&C Electric could be liable to Moore on a theory of negligence under Canadian law, the court must grant S&C Electric's motion for summary judgment, end quote. The plaintiff appealed. Pat, tell us about the case.
Very interesting set of facts here. In case it wasn't clear, the S&C Electric, which is not a small outfit here in Chicago, right? You see their trucks around and whatnot. They had an operation up in Canada, which the suggestion during the oral argument is they wanted to have these cameras in order to spy on the employees or something. That's the impression I get as to what these guys are up to up there. These fraudulent Canadians, these Canucks that apparently aren't, I don't know why, but anyway, they need to spy on these people was the suggestion. Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but that's what's the suggestion. And so they hire Reliable, who Moore works for. S&C, the mothership here in Chicago, hires Reliable to install these cameras at this facility up in Toronto for S&C Canada. And so we have this situation of this parent subsidiary situation. Now, when the case started, one of the issues was whether Canadian law applies or whether Illinois law applies to this. And they sued in Cook County in Illinois. And S&C Canada moved to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction. And the court agreed with that and dismissed S&C Canada, the subsidiary corporation, from the case because they had not done anything in Illinois. So you're only left with S&C Electric, the mothership, who had engaged Reliable, the plaintiff's employer, to go and do this work up in Toronto. these cross-border cases, I've had several of these over the years, and they give you a real appreciation for the amount of commerce that goes on in the Great Lakes region between particularly Ontario and Quebec and the Great Lakes states, of which Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, so forth, you know, Wisconsin, the amount of commerce that goes on around the Great Lakes. And you get an appreciation for how much business is really done between these states. Case I have right now, the design builders in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, the property, the project is in Indiana, and all of the engineers, of which I represent one of them, is are up in Quebec. So it's there's all this, there's a lot of this cross-border commerce, and you see it, and there's a lot of business that goes on between us, separated by the imaginary line of the border, but also all these lakes. So the court dismisses the Canadian entity, and so you're left with the primary entity, or the parent entity, as you know, whether you can get at them. And so the question, one of the issues was that it wasn't clear why it really mattered, because it didn't seem to be dispositive of which law applied. The court seemed at the oral argument to be blaming the plaintiff for arguing one thing and then arguing another about which law applied. The plaintiff filed here because there are damages on non-economic damages in there are caps on non-economic damages in Canada of about $300,000, if memory serves. And so they obviously did not want to file in Canada. They wanted to be here in the United States, where they can get a much larger recovery. And so at the time of this incident, you heard Dan talking about foreseeability. You had this boom truck, and the boom truck is going against traffic. And our hero, the plaintiff, is walking in front of the boom truck as it goes against traffic. And that didn't work out well. He was struck by, I presume, a car coming from the other direction, or a truck coming from the other direction. That is the correct direction. As he's walking on the road. Why? Who came up with this plan is really mind-boggling. And the idea is that without showing any control by the parent entity over what this person was doing, and it wouldn't be foreseeable that someone would engage in this kind of a conduct, that there was no recovery that could be made. I think that kind of makes sense. I don't understand how anyone would possibly think that someone would do what was done here. It's wild, frankly. If he had fallen off of the boom truck because he had slipped or something like that, that's certainly in the realm of possibility or realm of foreseeable. But there may be different defenses as to whether they had control and those kinds of things. But it's the idea that someone's going to walk against traffic and get hit is just wild. It's like, really, someone thought that was a good idea. And it turns out it wasn't. And this poor fellow was injured as a result. When I messaged Dan that we'd be talking about this case, there's a reference to depakage in the oral argument. I have to say, never have come across this term before or knew what it meant. Maybe I've heard the word, but I can't tell you what it meant. So I looked it up, and it turns out it's a civil law concept that finds its way into common law countries, so Canada, United States, Great Britain, Australia, so forth, common law countries. We come into this concept that you import the law from another place and which law applies, this kind of a thing. But that didn't really seem to drive, certainly didn't drive the circuit court's opinion, and didn't seem that it's going to inform the circuit court's opinion. I think the circuit court, or strike that, the appellate court, I think the appellate court's opinion is going to be based on this very straightforward application of Illinois law regarding responsibility for a subsidiary and that there really isn't without showing control, especially when this person is an employee of another entity entirely, who, as you know, just say the obvious, couldn't be sued directly by Moore because Reliable was his employer. So he couldn't sue them under the exclusive remedy of workers' compensation. Dan, what are your thoughts?
Not an interesting case, Pat, and these I agree with you. There's a lot of these cases where commerce in the Great Lakes region really is, they demonstrate that. I had a case several years ago I advised on that was turned out to be a malpractice case, case tried in Missouri. Legal malpractice. The lawyers, a tort and insurance firm, but it had to do with some Canadians that were, again, in a van of some sort. I can't remember the full facts now. It's been a while. And that van had gotten an accident of some sort in Missouri. And like you're talking about, a lot of debate about which laws applied because of the Canada laws. Like you talked about, there's limits on certain damages. And the lawyer, a very good lawyer, but he tried the case, but didn't really know conflicts or comparative law or Canadian law, and the judge came back, and it was pretty bad damages. So, I think the facts that I described at the beginning, hard to find how S&C Electric would be responsible for this, but very interesting case, and we'll see what the court does with it.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to take them very long to figure out what they're going to do. So we'll keep you apprised on this one. So with that, we'll take our first break and come back with Kuhn versus Auto Owners.
Hey, Podium and Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
We're back for segment two of episode 196, in what may be the conclusion of stacking cases in Illinois that have gone on for over 30 years. The Illinois Supreme Court will address the following question presented in Kuhn versus Auto Owners, Owners Insurance Company. Whether the owner's policy of insurance, which lists $1 million in liability limits seven different times covering seven different vehicles, is susceptible to the reasonable interpretation that the total available liability limits for a single motor vehicle collision is $7 million as per the Bruder dicta. More time spent on dicta than I ever thought anyone would spend, but that's what's driving this case. And what is the Bruder dicta? The Bruder dicta. It is the language from Bruder versus Country Mutual, 156 Ill Second, 179, 192 from 1993, the Illinois Supreme Court, in which the state high court stated, quote, there would be little to suggest in such a listing that the parties intended the coverage was to be limited to that provided for only one of the two vehicles. It would be more reasonable to assume that the parties intended that in return for two premiums, two $100,000 coverage amounts were afforded, end quote. However, in Hobbs versus Hartford Insurance Company of the Midwest, 214 Ill Second, 1126 footnote 1 from 2005, the court incited most recently in Hess versus Estate of Clam, 2020 Ill 12469, paragraph 22, the Illinois Supreme Court stated that Bruder, quote, should not be construed as establishing a per se rule that an insurance policy will be deemed ambiguous as to the limits of liability anytime the limits are noted more than once on the declarations. Full disclosure, I was at Pretzel when Hess versus Estate of Clam was handled. I wasn't involved in handling it, but my partner, Robert Chemers, argued the case. So with that, Dan, are your thoughts about, tell us about this case.
Sure, Pat. And a couple of things. You mentioned that the numbers were listed seven times. In this particular policy, there were seven vehicles. Each had $1 million limit. We've talked about this in preparation, Pat. These stacking cases, Illinois seems to be a bit of an outlier. And like many insurance issues in the state of Illinois, other insurance comes to mind where it took 25, 30 years to kind of root out and figure out what the courts in Illinois were going to do with other insurance provisions. Stacking is one of those where the issue becomes what money an insured has. And I think one of the interesting arguments, Pat, you talked about this, it's not to be construed as a per se rule. What the appellant advocate was arguing in this case was that per se doesn't mean that there's necessarily one rule, but that there's the general rule of Bruder, the dicta that you described and that they spent boatloads of time on during the oral argument, but that per se rule, you know, there can be changes, but the general rule is that there's this approach. One of the things that was mentioned in this case is that there was not only a general anti-stacking provision, but there was also a specific anti-stacking provision in this case. And what happens in these cases, Pat, and what's where the courts have found the ambiguity, I think, is that the non-stacking provisions always say, look at the limits of liability. In the Bruder case, I believe it was, but it may have been one of the other cases, what happened was that there were two vehicles on one page listed. They ran out of space that had the $1 million limit. And then you had to turn the page, and there was a second or a third car that was listed with another $1 million of coverage. And why does this matter? We talked about in the first segment limits of liability. In some of these cases where it's catastrophic, the reality here is that if you only have a $1 million coverage, you may get into issues of not enough coverage for the severity of the injury. And I'm not exactly sure what injuries took place here, but it sounds like they're pretty substantial. And so,
it involves a van full of student athletes. And deaths and catastrophic injuries. $7 million may not be enough based on what was described in the oral argument.
Right. And these generally arise in the uninsured, underinsured motorist arena. And again, it's looking at that public policy. One thing that you noted, Pat, when you sent this case was for whatever reason, Chief Justice Tice was not presiding at this hearing. It was Judge Neville. And, he, in fact, was involved in another case and bought onto it, and one of the appellant advocate reminded him of that. There was a second advocate for the appellant. She spoke very briefly. She was for, I think, two of the family members for the Kuhns, and she spoke very briefly about some of these cases that you would hear from the appellee in this case. These issues to me are very interesting because I think one of the things that also that doesn't get directly addressed, Pat, but we should consider and I think is one of the issues that I think not sure it gets squarely addressed, is that most of these policies have an occurrence limit and they have an aggregate limit, and for good reason, because you can't have a policy that just keeps paying. But the reality in this argument, as you mentioned, probably heard more about dicta in this case than we've heard in some time. I think this is an opportunity, and I think the advocates invited it, for the Illinois Supreme Court to clarify the dicta in Bruder, to correct it, and to give us some clarity on whether Hobbs, the per se rule, and ambiguity. Now, you and I both, we do a lot of work for the insurance industry, and the argument, I think, from the insurance industry is that there's ambiguity in some policy provisions, but this is not one of them. I thought the appellant on rebuttal had a very good example. He said he goes to an event down in, I think it was Champaign or Springfield. He takes his car to a banquet or a reception. He has two other teenage kids on this policy that are driving. So there's three cars that are, you know, he's from Chicago area, I take it. So he's got three cars with $1 million of coverage each, and that there's no way that the if he got in a car wreck down in Springfield, I think it was, or you know, wherever he was mentioning, that there would be no, it wouldn't be conceivable that he would seek to have additional coverage under those two other policies that are cars that are nowhere near where he's at. And so that's always been, I think, the challenge with the stacking cases and the ambiguity. But one of the things I think that came out of this hearing, and I think that's been an issue for 30 years with Hess and Bruder and all the other stacking cases, Pat, is that these cases tend to be very policy specific because the courts are looking at the specific language of the anti-stacking provision, which usually refers to the declaration page. And the declaration page often has these limits per vehicle or whatnot. The reason that insurance companies do this, again, these are vans and travel for student athletes, like you said. The reason I think that insurers do this is because, again, you want to make sure that and make it clear that there's not $7 million of coverage, or there's not, you know, that there's $1 million per vehicle. But I think that, you know, the takeaway from this, you know, pending what the Illinois Supreme Court rules in this case, I think is that insurers should be wise to revisit their limits and what they look like and figure out how the anti-stacking provision can fit within however the court rules in this case. So interesting issues, I think, and we'll see what the Illinois Supreme Court does. It seemed like a lot of questions for the appellant, not so much for the appellee, I don't think, and some real questions about Bruder and Hess and about, you know, how the court should move, and so we'll see what happens in this case.
The argument that wasn't raised is one that was raised in Hess, and that was that there's a policy reason why, and by policy, I mean public policy reason why, you can't have stacking of liability limits. Most of these cases arise in the uninsured or underinsured motorist context, not in the liability context. Now, Hess arose right in the liability context, and this case arose in the liability context. The court did not address the argument in Hess, and it wasn't raised here with respect to whether you could ever do this. It just doesn't make any sense in the liability context as the argument, because that's not the limits of liability that you purchased. In Hess, the issue was there were four vehicles, and the $1 million or the $300,000 was printed twice because the vehicles physically couldn't fit on one page of the declaration page. So it went on to a next page. So what happened in Hess was there were four vehicles, $300,000 each. The trial court said $1.2 million. The appellate court said, no, it's written twice, so $600,000. And the Supreme Court said, no, the language controls, you get one limit of $300,000, you're done. So in this case, it seems it's written $1 million after each vehicle. There doesn't seem to be the spacing issue that caused this problem, caused the problem at Hess. But then they have the very clear language. But the argument from the other side is, hold it, all that means is that there's a conflict between the language and the deck page, and where there's ambiguity, you should construe the coverage more broadly. But then there's you have to read the policy as a whole, and I don't understand how you could possibly read a policy as a whole and come up with $7 million in this case. But we'll see what the Supreme Court has to say. That's why we have a case. So with that, we'll take our next break. I'm sorry, Dan?
No, I agree.
So with that, we'll take our next break and come back with Rice versus Marathon.
Hey, Podium and Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
Welcome back to segment 3 of episode 196 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. Like the issue, the Illinois Supreme Court will consider in Triplex Technical Services Limited versus John Don LLC, the State High Court, and Rice versus Marathon will consider whether a private right of action is expressed or implied to support a strict liability claim that allows recovery for punitive damages separate and apart from the negligence claim the plaintiff has already recovered under. Both cases involve environmental laws. John Don involves the Detergents Act, 415 LCS 92/5, while the court in Rice will consider the 415 LCS 5/1 at SEC, Illinois Environmental Protection Act, 415 LCS 5/57 at SEC, Title 16, Petroleum Underground Storage Tanks, 430 LCS 15 at SEC, Gasoline Storage Act, and 48 other statutes and regulations from which the appellate discerns a private right of action. The plaintiff's mother was injured when gasoline fumes migrated 1.5 miles from the defendant gas station and were sparked by her laundry machine. The mother subsequently died of unrelated causes, and the plaintiff argues that punitive damages under the statutory cause of action do not abate as they do for common law rights of action. The negligent counts were settled and a good faith finding entered with 304A language. The parties disagree whether the statutory claims survived the settlement of the negligence claims, but the larger issue is the proper manner to determine if a private right of action exists. Pat, tell us about this case.
Thanks, Dan. And I learned this past week that there's actually a bill to create the private cause of action the Gasoline Storage Act. To create this action that did previously exist. So what happened in this case is really, I think as one justice described it, pretty egregious. The allegations are, and I don't think they're disputed, is that the company had like a 9,000 gallon gasoline tank in the ground. And they were getting all kinds of warnings about problems, and they kept putting gasoline in the thing. And the gasoline got out of the tank and migrated and had this giant explosion. Not just this person, but others were injured as well. So really not good. The kind of conduct that, if alleged, which wasn't, might fall into the category of willful and wanton misconduct, which shows a conscious disregard for the safety of others. We're going to talk about another case about ultra-hazardous activities next week from the Indiana Supreme Court. But this week we'll talk about this one. So they settle the negligence claims, and apparently they settled the negligence claims for a song. Because their real focus was on the punitive on this statutory right of action, which they claim has two bizarre characteristics. Beyond the fact that it exists, and if you have to look at 48 different statutes to figure out if the thing exists, I'm going to go with the legislature did not create a private right of action. That's just, it's kind of like That's kind of like the detailed analysis I got one time from a judge. He holds up the motion for summary judgment in one hand. He holds up the response in another, kind of pretends like he's weighing them. He goes, there's got to be a question of fact in here somewhere. You got if you've got 48 plus 51 statutes you're looking at to see if there's a private right of action. No, because guess what? The General Assembly of Illinois knows how to do is write a private cause of action. You know, in this case, what it says is this statute doesn't disparage already existing causes of action. That doesn't mean there's a new one.
Right.
So went the argument from the appellee. So the two peculiar things they're claiming about this private right of action, beyond the fact that it exists, which is peculiar enough, they're claiming that it survives her death, number one. And number two, they could get punitive damages on it. Oh, and I forgot, there's a third one. And it still exists, notwithstanding their dismissal and settlement of the negligence claims. So there's a lot of hurdles here. And if you, I'll make an analogy here to the Trump. The Trump versus Anderson case. The proponents of. Sorry, I hit the cough button because I really needed to sneeze. The proponents of the position that you could bar the president, or in this case Donald Trump, you had to clear 75 hurdles, and you had to clear them all. Whereas if Trump was right on any one of them, it was done. Now, as it turned out, they didn't get past the starting gate. They didn't get past the first one, that it was self-executing, which I think most folks kind of took for granted, and they were on to the more difficult issues. But in this case, they've got a number of hurdles the plaintiffs do to try to get here. Number one, it doesn't abate. Number two, it exists. Or number one, it exists. Number two, it doesn't abate. And number three, you get punitive damages out of it because you've already collected these other. So they've got a number of hurdles they've got to get through. I don't think they clear any of them, frankly. I don't understand how you settle a part of your case and somehow you still get another bite at the apple. I mean, if she didn't think that the resolution of the negligence claims was sufficient, then why settle them? And I also don't understand why settle them at all. Why settle them? There's something we're plainly missing, because the lawyers for the plaintiffs are really good. There's something we're missing here.
Yeah.
It was Michael Reagan who argued for the appellant, right? Dan, am I got that right?
I think
and
so.
He's an excellent advocate. He really
is
trying to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear in this case. I don't think it can be done, but he's going to give them as good a chance as anyone of getting it done. I just don't see it working under these facts. These facts are bizarre. The underlying facts are troubling, that gas could migrate. Now, at the oral argument, they said it had migrated 7 miles, whereas when I went and read the opinions from the appellate court, it's only a mile and a half, so I had to amend the post. Somebody pointed that out for me, so I'm glad I got that corrected. But even a mile and a half, how the heck does that happen? It's wild. It's
crazy.
I've heard of gas explosion. Usually it's inside the building where the leak is occurring. No. This is like going from the Marathon station, mile and a half up the road, and then migrating to this poor lady's house, and she's got a pilot light or whatever. She turns on the thing and up it goes. It's just awful. So I really don't understand why they didn't plead willful and wanton misconduct. I think they probably could have gotten past the hurdle of 604.1, pled punitive damages, got them. I don't know why they took short money, what appears to be short money, on the negligence counts, because they plainly had negligence. They probably could have gotten punitive damages. I don't know what the strategy was here. There's something we're plainly missing. But I don't think this is going to work. Dan, your thoughts?
I completely agree with you, Pat. I don't know why they took that money. I don't know if maybe they thought with all the statutory, all these other things, that somehow that would work. But yeah, it seems like something missing here that we didn't hear in oral arguments. I'm not quite clear what's going on.
To quote George's mother from the infamous dinner when George Costanza's father's going on about the chicken. Yeah, there's something missing here. And there's something missing here. Oh, with that brings us to B.I. Bippa Gippa Ippa. We got three B.I. cases, Dan.
Yeah.
We had one we discussed on episode 186, Q Excelsior Italia. Great name for a hotel, by the way.
It is.
Versus Zurich, because it's in Rome. And they obviously had a problem, especially in Italy early, with COVID. And that didn't work. Episode 186, we discussed that on. And then the California appellate court said a La Jolla coffee shop could proceed with their lawsuit. So that continues. The California Supreme Court, as we've talked about, had an oral argument a couple weeks ago. I still can't find the oral argument. They live stream, but apparently they don't archive it. Either that or I'm too stupid to find it. Probably the latter.
Now, there's a few states where that's the case. They live stream, but for some reason, I've had that before, looking at a state. And if you miss a live stream, for whatever reason, they don't post it, or it takes a long time to post or something. It's very bizarre.
Very strange. So I'll keep an eye on that, because we'd like to talk about that case and I'd like to listen to it, even if we don't talk about it, but I can't find it. And then the D.C. Court of Appeals affirmed a dismissal in a COVID-19 case. So, Dan, I want to ask a question, because I guess I don't understand something. What is the D.C. Court of Appeals? Is that the D.C.? That's not the D.C. Circuit.
No.
They have their own, like, state equivalent system, right?
Yeah.
Or no?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
And is there a D.C. Supreme Court?
There's not, I don't think.
Okay, so it has there isn't an intermediate court of review for ordinary civil disputes that don't go into federal court, even though it's in the District of Columbia, so it's kind of a federal court anyway.
Yeah, right.
The very odd machinations of the District of Columbia and what it is, because it's a strange thing that exists in our law. So I said, D.C. Court of Appeals, that doesn't sound like the circuit court. What's going on here? All right. Our prediction's sure to go wrong. Dan, not a great week.
No.
We were half, 1.5, and 3. So now Dan is 363-24. I am 297-66-22. I think that's right. We got one half right and half wrong. One half right and half wrong, Jackson versus EB. So this is the case where the fellow was walking in a construction zone. He gets hit by a car on a rainy night. That doesn't go well. He sues, among others, the general contractor, a subcontractor, and the owner's representative. We thought that the owner's representative was going to have a problem. All three got summary judgment from the trial court. And as it turned out, the appellate court affirmed for all three. That's why we only got half. I mean, if we really want to be technical, we got it 2/3 right and 1/3 wrong. But I can't do that math with the adding the decimals and whatnot. So my math isn't that good. I'm not my daughter. And so I'm not doing that. So I just went half and half and called it good. We got... Anything to add on that one, Dan?
No.
Interesting case, though, is that they didn't have a duty to alert the city that there was a problem potentially with these plans. Brings us to Project 44 versus Four Kites from the Illinois Supreme Court that we discussed in episode 189. This is a really interesting and important decision. Following the majority of jurisdictions that have addressed the issue and finding that a corporation has its own reputation to protect, the Illinois Supreme Court held in Project 44 versus Four Kites that publication for the purposes of defamation occurs when communications about a corporation are made to officers and directors of the corporation. I don't understand this decision. We got this wrong. Dan, can you explain this decision to me? I don't get it.
I don't get it either. I really don't understand it. I am very surprised by it, honestly.
I'm surprised to learn, as I did in reading the opinion, that this is the majority position.
Yeah.
And what this essentially does is where there are damage or strike that, an allegation of defamation per se, as is the case here. They alleged all kinds of nefarious conduct that is between two competitors. So this was done, the allegation is this was done to try to screw with the business of a competitor. So it's really nasty stuff that's alleged. I don't know if any of it's true. That's not the point. The issue is they send this somebody sends this email to under a fake, not a real email address, but a fake, you know, it's all made up. And it sends the email address. I don't know if any of it's true. I'm trying to be clear here. These people are suing each other for defamation. I'm trying not to defame people. I don't know if any of this is true. But what we do know is that, or what we seem to know from the opinion is that they used a fake email address to try to hide who they were. So it didn't come from the competitor Forkites to the folks at Project 44. But what it essentially does is it means they don't have to prove damages because they've alleged per se. They've alleged per quad too, but they also have to prove publication because we sent it. We don't know if anybody else found out about it. I mean, frankly, Project 44, the only reason anyone knows about any of this stuff is because they filed suit.
Right.
You know, I understand that you're mad that somebody's trying to screw with your business, but I don't understand how that's publication.
Nope.
Help me out, Dan. Do you have any assistance to offer?
Nope.
I'm not suggesting that what's alleged here is good. It's not. It's bad behavior. You shouldn't do that. But I don't understand how it's legally cognizable as publication. If they had sent it to the Chicago Tribune, or they sent it to another competitor, or they sent it to a customer, well, sure. And the customer, it might even be tortious interference on top of it. But among other claims, perhaps. But I don't understand how sending it internally is a thing. But it is. So there we are. Now we have the answer. Which brings us to the three cases we punted on, all from the Supreme Court of the United States. FCRA versus United States. A unanimous decision, right? Written by Justice Barrett. I believe. Episode 186, we discussed. This is a case where Jonas FCRA, a Sudanese national who emigrated to the United States many years ago, and so he's a United States citizen. He gets put on the no-fly list for reasons that they won't tell him. He isn't able to come back to the United States after going to the United Arab Emirates and then to Sweden and all other kinds of other places. He finally gets, Sweden pays for a private jet to bring him back, but now he sues, and they take him off the no-fly list after he sues, but they won't tell him so he can avoid the behavior that got him on the list in the first place. And the government argued successfully that it was moot. And the Supreme Court said, no, that's not how this works. You can't moot the case by ceasing your ridiculously stupid conduct. You know, FCRA, they didn't have evidence that FCRA was making bombs in the basement. Had they, I'm sure they would have done a lot more than put him on the no-fly list. Apparently he was going to the wrong mosque. You can't do that. Just because you go to the mosque doesn't mean you don't get to fly an airplane. Fly on it, or even fly on an airplane. Anything to add on FCRA, Dan?
Nope.
Okay, which brings us to Lidke and O'Connor, both of which we discussed on episode 175. And these are, I will say this, Dan, I cannot believe how many First Amendment cases there are this term.
There's a lot.
There were two this past week. There's ones we haven't talked about, the net choice cases. There are the jawboning cases. There's the Gonzalez case that's been argued. There's the NRA case that's going to argue. There are going to be 10 First Amendment cases this term, something like that. I mean, I'm in the ballpark. It's wild. It turns out no one knows what the First Amendment says, or at least we can't agree on it. So Freed versus O'Connor, Freed and O'Connor, these are two cases that dealt with local officials who used their social media platforms to box out the other side the people that were criticizing them, and the court held that they made up a standard for how you figure that out and sent the cases back. And these were both opinions written by Barrett, right?
I think so. Yep.
Yeah, and yeah. So they sent these things back. Dan, any thoughts on those?
Nope.
Okay. Which brings us to our prediction sure to go wrong for this week. Moore versus S&C affirmed?
I think so.
Kuhn versus Auto or versus Owners affirmed?
Affirmed.
And Rice versus Marathon affirmed, right?
Affirmed. I think a 3 affirmed this week.
Yeah, I think that's right. Which brings us to the rule of the week. Dan, why don't you tee this one up?
Sure. So the ABA on the model rules of professional conduct from time to time issues formal opinions. They've issued them on technology and competency. We've talked about those, I think, previously on this show. They've talked about a lot of other things. The most recent opinion really is addresses conflicts and what to do, and it talks about the reasonable measures necessary to avoid the imputation of conflicts of interest under Rule 1.18. Pat, tell us a little more about this, and we can then chat about the challenges that conflicts create and kind of how the profession goes about them.
Yeah, so this is a ABA Formal Opinion 510, and this is specifically dealing with the circumstance where you don't yet get engaged. You're in the pre-engagement discussions about the matter, and you get information, however, that might give you information about, private confidential information, 1.6 information for a shorthand, about the potential client. And they suppose they don't become a client. But later on, one of your partners or one of your colleagues gets the case, it gets the matter in. Well, I will say this, in a firm of, our firm is about 380. Dan, your firm is what, over 500?
Five-ish. I mean, give or take, probably over now.
Yeah. Right. And so let's just say conflicts are a constant issue. I'm constantly dealing with conflicts. But I'll tell you that if I have a conversation with somebody about potentially taking on a matter, it wouldn't show up on a conflict check. Because if we didn't bring it in, that's why you have to be very careful to the extent you can about whether you're going to bring the matter in. Because it's not going to show up. Because let's suppose one of my other partners from another office ends up being on the other side of the thing, they could try to get us disqualified. And you may or may not be able to be shielded if the conflict arises. And there is an ever increasing number. This was talked about at the Hinshaw risk management conference a couple weeks ago about the ever increasing number of motions to disqualify. And this is part of that, where you get information. I mean, the classic example is from The Sopranos. We probably talked about this before, where Tony goes around and conflicts out every divorce lawyer in town when Carmela and he are thinking about getting a divorce. And that's how he deals with, making sure she can't get a lawyer. He conflicts every lawyer out in town. This is that. And issues are really challenging in firms, large and small. Large, it's an even bigger problem, but small has the problem too, because it doesn't end up on the list. Dan, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's, conflicts, as you said, is a very tough thing, no matter what size of firm you have. I've been at small firms in my career where conflicts have arisen. And so, and as we've talked about, Pat, the challenges is that every firm has a little different approach to how they handle these. But like you said, the biggest problem here is that a lot of these don't make the list because you have a lot of conversations about representation on a regular basis, right? And the bigger the firm, the more conversations you have. There's a lot of work that goes into business development and prospecting. There's also a situation, both you and I in the last few years have changed firms, and you create that issue as you come over to a new firm. So A lot of things to consider. Your firm probably, just as mine, has an entire group of people that work on this stuff, on every aspect of opening files, including the conflict check, intake, you know, doing the initial conflicts, family trees of clients. And that's, you know, one of the things I think that's always a challenge in these things, too. We talked about the S&C case, you know, earlier in this podcast. Subsidiaries, affiliates, parents, related entities, joint ventures. When you're submitting these conflict checks, what parties do you actually put down? You know, I do these arbitrations often, and sometimes the claimants will name a party that may not be the actual party, you know, and so our conflicts group will take a check at that and look at that and then try to revise and make sure that the entire family of companies is being looked at. So interesting formal opinion. And these formal opinions, again, they're not necessarily, just like the Illinois State Bar issues opinions about various ethical things. They're formal opinions. They have weight, but they're not, it's not like they're case law. But these would be cited if someone were to run afoul of these things. To, you know, they would say, well, formal opinion 510 states X, Y, Z. You failed to follow it.
Yeah, it's at best persuasive.
Yeah.
The folks that write them are scholars in this area. Who've spent a lot of time. They only issue 3 or 4 or so a year, the ABA. Yeah. So it's they're very thoughtful. Sometimes I disagree with them. Sometimes they find them extraordinarily helpful. There was one recently, I think we talked about it on the show, about how to properly and ethically prepare someone for deposition. Yep. And that was an extremely helpful discussion of the ethics of deposition preparation. That's pretty good. Anyway, so with that, we will take our leave and we'll see everybody next week on the Podium and Panel podcast.
I'm Dan Cotter, and on behalf of my co-host, Pat Eckler, we thank you for listening and look forward to having you join us again. Please follow us on LinkedIn and read our columns in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Please join us again at the Podium and Panel. Each episode on the Podium and Panel podcast, we will cover several oral arguments and decisions in civil matters at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court, with the occasional coverage of SCOTUS and other appellate courts. The purpose of the podcast is to inform of developments that may affect business and are not to be considered legal advice. They do not create a lawyer-client relationship. Information on previous case results do not guarantee a similar future result. The opinions are their own and do not reflect those of the firms for which they work or their clients.